Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Hello, and welcome to Your Partner in Success. Ed, I've done this for the last 3 weeks. I cannot say the word success. I have cursed myself. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I am so sorry. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am honored to share the microphone with the most interesting business leaders. Now, these are people who have wonderful stories to share, and they're here on this podcast to freely share their journeys, their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice. In short, they're willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And in fact, my guests are so compelling and so insightful that this podcast was cited on Inc.com as one of the best business podcasts you need to be listening to and has been mentioned on Entrepreneur and MSNBC. And our topic today is such an important one. It's called The Symptoms of Poor Leadership with my guest, Ed Epley, who will be discussing performance management and the symptoms of poor leadership, something that affects so many companies, big to small. So Ed Epley is a leading global expert in professional management, sales strategy, and performance management. He is a principal consultant for the Table Group and also operates the Epley Group, E-P-P-L-E-Y, by the way. He has worked with executive teams at multinational companies across the U.S., Europe, China, Japan, and Australia. His clients include a who's who of business category leaders such as BMW, DSW, Sara Lee, Bloomberg, Battelle, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, Speedway, Steamboat Ski and Resort Company, Value City Furniture, PSA Airlines, I'm running out of breath, Emerson Electric, NECCO, NECO, Safelite Auto Glass, and many others. So as a facilitator for the course for presidents at, say this for me, Ed, Aileron.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in the South. We do it wrong all the time. In Tipp City, Ohio, he helps owners of private businesses apply a system of professional management to identify and correct workplace problems. So as a professional career that has spanned more than 40 years, he has honed a skill for identifying talent, understanding executive challenges, and spotting and improving problematic management. I am going to need a course in miracles to get through this, I think. Ed, good morning. And welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I don't know why I can't talk. It's one of the things that I do very well. But today, not happening. Sorry.
Well, I appreciate that you're just going right along with it. And one of the things that gets in the way of all of us in our work probably is seeking perfection. And getting in the way of progress. So I'm glad you're not seeking perfection today. And obviously you're not, because you invited me to speak. So I'm a long way from perfect.
I'm a recovering perfectionist. So you know I'm trying to give it up today. Apparently, but thank you for being with me. Your publicist sent me your book. It's not published yet, I don't think, but I have a pre-publication copy of your book that I'm reading this weekend. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
It has actually been launched. So it is officially out there. It's called Let's Be Clear. And it's about the six disciplines for professional management that I believe really can make a difference for most businesses and frankly for most executives, owners, presidents, CEOs, anybody at the top of the organization. It provides a common language for how you should probably at least give some consideration for operating the business. And then it also, with that common language, becomes a way to have common definitions for the different functions of management and leadership that we need in order to scale and run a business in a sustainable, profitable way. But I do want to just talk for a moment. You mentioned Aileron, and a lot of the impetus for the book came from the work that I've done there. And Aileron is a not-for-profit entity that was the brainchild of a gentleman whose name is Clay Mattil. Clay was the owner of Iams Dog and Cat Food, Pet Foods, if you're familiar with that name, Denise.
I just
made an
order
and still
this
are.
Morning.
Yeah. Yep. So they've been known for a long time as being really one of the premier pet foods in terms of nutrition and extending the healthy life of dogs and cats. And Clay installed professional management in his business back when it was probably about a $10 million business, and was able then, as a result of professional management, to be able to take the company to almost $1 billion in sales when he sold it to Procter & Gamble in 1999 for about $2.3 billion. And Clay's belief is that Aileron's mission is to help individuals and entities run more successful businesses so that they can employ more people and make the communities in which they operate more sustainable and better places to live. So I'm fortunate to be one of the fellows who gets to present the course for presidents about, they do it about monthly, and so I do it about six times a year. And it really is a wonderful entity who improves the quality of life for a lot of individuals, organizations, and communities. So thank you for letting me give them a little bit of a promotion.
Oh, absolutely.
The book that I've written called Let's Be Clear talks about the six disciplines of professional management, and one of them is leadership. And I believe from our previous conversations, you'd like to hear a little bit more about what I've written about the signs of problematic leadership. And so we'll start down that path. And if it prompts any questions on your part or observation, certainly let's talk about it.
Absolutely.
Number one, when leadership is weak in an organization or on a team, your talent will depart. And it's probably your best talent because those people, the best people on your team, want to be managed and led in a really high level. They're glad to follow, provided that it's following somebody who they have confidence in and you know, belief in their competency to be able to take the team or the organization to a better place. So if your leadership is weak, one sign that it is weak will be some of your better people will probably be opting out. They may tell you that it's because of pay. They may tell you it's because of a great opportunity. But a lot of times those are code words for you're just not getting it done for me. So that's one thing that I always ask the organizations with whom I work is how much voluntary turnover of above average talent are you seeing? And, you know, there's always a right level of that, and you do need some of that to keep the organization growing and healthy and create opportunity for others. But there's also a level above which it's indications that there are problems with the leader of the organization. The other second indicator that I see a lot of times is productivity is at best flat and oftentimes will be declining. So the amount of labor or energy that has to be expended to produce whatever the value is that the organization produces is not keeping pace with what the rising costs of the business are. So as a result, my output year over year is not as good as it needs to be to keep up with the rising costs of doing business. And so when there's a healthy organization, when there's a strong organization and strongly led, normally those kinds of indications of declining productivity or flat productivity are not going to be there. The other part of the equation, Denise, is that people who are fully engaged, fully committed, because in part of the leader, will work harder and will try more often to do more than they have to. And so that's another reason why we'll see flat or declining productivity when leadership is in question. The next indicator that I often see will be difficulty in profitable growth. So a lot of times a person who's enthusiastic might be thought of as a great leader, but if they're not leading with a purpose, if they're not leading with some kind of target and getting alignment with the people around them about what this is and why it's important, then there's a lot of energy and effort that will be expended, but a lot of times then it will also not result in the profitable growth of the organization. They might get bigger, but they may not see a corresponding increase in the profitability of the business. How are we doing so far?
Great. I have a question about leaders, though. So you're saying it kind of as a singular, like, head of an organization, but I'm guessing that that's not actually the case, that you're talking about a leader at any organizational level, whether they're in charge of a department, whether they're in charge of a team. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. There's a responsibility to lead almost daily for all of us, whether we have a formal title of a manager or a executive or not. So we have opportunities to cause people to want to go in a direction. We have opportunities to get people to want to support ideas or things that we think could or should be done to help the family, the schools in which our kids go, churches or social groups with which we're a part. So the whole idea is we do have these moments and opportunities where all of us get a chance to lead. But in business, typically the responsibility to lead come from the president, CEO, or owner, and then her or his direct reports typically will also have great opportunities to lead and influence the way people want to behave. And leadership is all about getting whatever group that you're trying to influence to want to go to a place and go and actually get to a place where they're better off or that they're more sustainable in some way for whatever the entity is about. And so when we talk about leadership, we are talking about that the framework for that and the I guess you would say the DNA for the organization will almost always come from the person who is at the highest point of the hierarchy. So if we talk about the president, she or he, however good they are as a leader, is probably going to put some kind of artificial limit on the capacity for great leadership within the rest of the organization. John Maxwell is a famous author, and he talks about in one of his books the law of the lid. And his premise would be that the overall leadership of the organization will never be better than the top leader of the organization. And I do believe to a great deal, you can be a great leader under a very poor leader, but the capacity that you will have to get results will still be constrained by whatever lack of leadership goes on above you. So it's probably disappointing to hear that, but at the same time, I think it's a harsh reality. Did I answer your question, Denise, about who gets a chance to lead?
Yeah, and it does make sense. I mean, you watch what's going on, sometimes even as a consumer. You may be calling into Cox Communications, who, by the way, I can't stand. I'm very vocal about it, but pretty much that we're held hostage by them in my part of the country. And I am convinced that there is an entire room of people that when they see my number pop up or I announce myself as Denise Griffiths, that they just do this whole body freeze on, like, oh, my God. And I'm never ugly. I'm never nasty. But I'm consistent in my complaints with them. Like, can you just fix it? Let's fix it today, if you could. Thank you very much. But I watched them, and I'm just using them as example because I can. I seriously have questions about their leadership. I really do, just based on the amount of communication I have to have with them for a service that I'm paying a good deal of money for each month. And my complaints don't vary. I have a list. Okay, let's check off 1, 2, 5. Dang it, come on, fix it. So that has to be coming from the top, yeah?
Yeah, I directly or indirectly, it absolutely is. It's interesting because a lot of times the person that is formally at the top of the hierarchy, that person will many times when you talk to them say all the right things. They'll and I think believe all the right things, but there oftentimes will also be a disconnect between what they espouse as is most important for the organization. They'll talk about the importance of customer engagement and satisfaction. Yet, when push comes to shove, there's probably these critical moments in time where the formal leader of the organization makes choices, and those choices reflect a direction that's different than what they would say is most important. So they'll say one thing is most important, but their behavior will indicate that something else is most important. And in a case like the one you're just describing,
right,
somebody at the top of Cox will say, no, we care about our customers. They're critical. We want to take care of them. And yet there's probably pressure put on, and constraints put on what can be done to solve a customer problem for financial reasons in most cases that make its way down to the people that you're trying to resolve your problem with. And their hands are oftentimes tied. And they get frustrated, and that frustration that they have with their own organization oftentimes manifests itself in not necessarily being nice or patient with you.
Oh, they're always nice and patient. I'm nice and patient with them. I don't believe in getting nasty or ugly or cursing. That gets you nowhere. But I do expect
Correct.
Service that I'm paying for. One of the things that bothers me about Cox, and I suspect that this is from the top down, is that they will invariably, I mean, without fail, well, Mrs. Griffiths, I'm so sorry to hear this. Yeah, and I will tell them, please stop telling me you're sorry, because they will start every other sentence, well, I'm really sorry that you're having these troubles. That doesn't get us anywhere.
And
so who is telling you to stop that nonsense? No, they don't. And I have gotten to where when I call them, which is regularly, we have nice little coffee chats, I will start my conversation out by, listen, please do not tell me how sorry you are every five or six sentences. I'm just going to tell you right now, that will irritate me beyond endurance, and this could get ugly quickly. So let's just take that off of your spiel, and let's get down to what we can do to fix this. And then they'll instantly say, sorry. Like they are literally conditioned to constantly apologize, which bugs me no end, as you can hear.
Yeah, well, they're clearly well-trained. Unfortunately, they're not given a way to resolve it. And truthfully, the recordings, the calls are recorded, and a lot of times people will be listening to them. And if they don't say they're sorry, they probably get written up as not doing their job correctly.
That's why I give them permission instantly. Do not tell me you're sorry. Just fix it.
But you giving them permission to these does not mean that they won't get in trouble if they don't say that they're sorry. So, again, I guess it's a case where, again, what you need them to do is not the way they're either incentivized or managed and clearly led. Because ultimately they should be given some kind of power to either correct your problem or give you some reduction in cost for lack of value that you're supposed to be receiving. But unfortunately, it sounds like it's Groundhog Day all over again.
I'm glad you said that, because now every time I call them, I say, listen, credit me for today. Yes, ma'am. They don't even argue anymore.
Well, it sounds like you're starting to at least have some impact on their meeting.
I do. I don't have any impact on speed and quality, but I have some impact on how we all communicate.
I know. Well, hopefully the next time we'll talk, you'll have started to experience better quality service. Okay.
I'm sure you have some ideas, maybe a little mini list of what makes a great leader. So if you can share that when you're ready.
Sure, I will. There are three other things that probably will be to one degree or another an indicator of a quality of leadership. Low employee satisfaction or morale, or formal rated engagement. So in other words, if you formally measure the employee satisfaction or morale of your organization, what you're going to see is that it's probably, relative to benchmarking you might do with other kinds of organizations, not as high as it could or should be. So that would be another indicator that leadership is not necessarily as good as it can be for your organization. Another indicator would be lack of bench strength. And when we talk about bench strength, it's really talking about the available talent that could be promoted if an opportunity presented itself. And so often when leadership is lacking, it's not that employees aren't working hard and trying hard, but there's probably not any emphasis put on preparing people for what eventually is going to be required, which is we're going to need other people if we're a growing, thriving organization to step up and fill roles for management leadership that currently they're not in. And again, if those roles have to be filled by going outside the organization, I would question the leadership level of the organization. And the last one is inconsistent results. I see a lot of companies who will have a great year followed by one or two marginal years and then maybe a rebound. But it's not consistent. And that kind of whipsawing between above average or, you know, improvement or lack of improvement, again, would indicate that the leader or leaders of the organization are probably not keeping their eye on the right things. They're probably spending too much time dealing with reactive situations rather than proactive, which I think is something that we always have to keep in mind is how reactive or proactive do we really want to be. And in some businesses are by nature, you know, if I'm a job shop, if I'm a tow truck company, well, you're probably more often dealing with responding to whatever the market gives you rather than being able to drive it. But most companies are not necessarily by nature in that reactive mode. Give me your next question again, Denise, so I answer it correctly. What would you like me to comment on?
I wanted you to give us some little thumbnail sketches of what makes a good leader, because that's a toughie. You know, a lot of people will think that they're really great leaders. I mean, I often think I'm a good leader, and then my cat bites my ankle, and I realize that I am not in control of anything. So, I think great leaders, and that leads me to my observation, that great leaders have to be proactive. They have to be visionaries, but they also have to be a bit humble, don't they? So I would love to hear your take.
Well, in my work with the Table Group, one of the books that Pat Lencioni has written is called The Ideal Team Player, and he makes reference to the three characteristics that we think tend to be fairly universal. Number one is humility, which we call humble. The second characteristic is hungry, which means they have the right kind of drive, the right level of drive, without being, you know, corrosive or doing damage because of how focused and driven they might be. And the last one is smart, and it's not IQ, but it's emotional intelligence. It's the ability to understand the impact you have on others and to actually care about it enough to sometimes be measured in how you behave and what you say and when you say it. And it's also your ability to receive input from other people, either directly or otherwise, and also take appropriate action based upon that input. So that combination of humble, hungry, and smart is a kind of a can't miss in most cases of what would be inspiring for most of us in a great leader. But beyond that, the things that I think you probably want to think about is, number one, that they're authentic. That the person you're talking to is not some facade. It's not some effort to clone yourself after somebody else that's really not who you are, but rather it's the best version of your best self that's going to reach the people that you're trying to take in a particular direction. The other thing is highly respected, which allows them to be then highly trusted. And in my world, I believe that before you can be trusted, you have to be respected. And the components for respect means that I'm going to be very competent in the work that I do. And it does not mean that I'm the technical expert in everything, Denise, but it does mean that I demonstrate that when required, I can absolutely produce the results that go with the level of responsibility I have. And then combined with that, there are the people skills that I use. There's the attitude that I exhibit in how I treat others. Either how I treat you or how you see me treat others will have a huge impact on the level of respect that you give me. And it's only when you respect me that I start to have influence. And then it's only when you respect me because of my competency and the people skills that I exhibit, the way that I treat you or others, that you're starting to be willing to take risk with me and make yourself vulnerable, which is really what trust is all about. I think another great characteristic of outstanding leaders will be their ability to create purpose behind whatever you're going to ask people to do. When we talk about purpose, it's Simon Sinek always talks about his golden circle, which is the why, behind how you do what you do and the what you do. And so I'm really believing more than ever that when you have purpose, you've got currency for being able to get engagement of the people that you're managing and leading. And the greater the purpose and the higher that purpose is, the more aspirational it is, generally speaking, the more opportunity you have to really attract and retain great people around you. So I do think that purpose that the leader can provide and continues to reiterate is really, really crucial. And then there's this other aspect of leadership that I think is somewhat overlooked and underappreciated. I think great leaders have the understanding and the wherewithal to know how to set really tough, challenging targets that initially a lot of people will go, there's no way we can do that. There's no possibility. That is such a big target. There's no way that we could hit it. And yet great leaders find ways to set the bar at a level that it really will allow people to do much better work and produce much greater results than they would ever think possible. And I don't know if you work out, Denise. You strike me as the kind of person who would. But I typically, in the work, in the physical activity that I do, I spend time with the trainer usually once to twice a week. And Julie is her name. And Julie has this wonderful capacity, far more in terms of what I would lift or the speed at which I do something, the energy that I'll expend, than I would on my own. And a great leader, I think, has the ability to do that in a way that does not demoralize the people that she or he leads. If you allow me, I want to add one more thing to great leadership qualities, and that is they are not hostages. Leaders, great leaders, are not hostages to doing things only one way. So they will become a better version of themselves. They will evolve. They will not always use the same strength in the same situation. They will recognize there's times where they cannot just rely on what got them there to be able to get the organization to another level. So they will grow. They will evolve. They will work on their weaknesses so that they can become more flexible or have more capacity to work in more different kinds of situations. So I don't know. Does that give you a good shopping list of the attributes that will make somebody more of a great leader?
Yes, absolutely. And what you just talked about, you know, where leaders are agile and they're growing and they're learning from the people that they work with that may work under them in some capacity or work for them, however you want to say it, that really goes to emotional intelligence, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I've got one particular leader. I can't reveal the company with whom he's a part. The frustrating thing for him and even his team is he knows – his weaknesses for the most part. He has such a difficult time reining those in or managing those weaknesses in certain situations. And he'll literally say, I know I shouldn't do this. And then he goes ahead and does it.
Uh-oh. Somebody needs to hold up a sign, then don't do it.
Oh, yeah. And usually he does not do that as much when I'm present as when I'm absent. But the point I would make there is it's one thing to know yourself. It's another to be able to control yourself, right? It's another to be able to not say certain things or to speak up when you're not comfortable, you know. And it's not always saying things that you shouldn't. Sometimes it's you don't say things that you should. And so, again, most of us as leaders only become really self-aware of what we do that really has value or what we do that gets in the way of creating value way, way, way too late in our careers.
Okay, Ed, without giving away too much of who this is or the company is, can you give us an example or two of what happens maybe around the boardroom table when he says, I shouldn't be saying this or doing this, but, I mean, do faces fall? Do, you know, spines slump? Do people just go, ah, crap? What happens?
Boy, it sounds like you've sat in the room with me. a couple of things happen, Denise, and there one is one of the habits that he will exhibit is spending his, he will make the point he needs to make in the first 30 to 60 seconds. And then he will talk further for another 3 to 5 minutes, trying to further build the case that he's already made and successfully made in the first 30 to 60 seconds. Well, a couple of things happen. There's an old rule in selling, which is give your prospects enough information, but no more to convince them that they're justified in buying. And which really means give them enough, but no more. And any more that you give them really hurts the case. And that's exactly what he does.
Yeah, don't talk them
out
of it.
So what ends up happening is, exactly. So when the moment that he passes the what he needed to say for his own emotional gratification of being able to get these thoughts and ideas out, the people stop listening. They tune him out. They start thinking about other things, and they also say in their own head, you know, he knows he shouldn't be doing this, but he still does. And as a result, they question his competency. So I'm going to say that again. They lose respect for him because we talked earlier, one of the key components for respect is to be competent at your job. And when he violates this simple rule of how much he should be saying to get his point across, then people question, you know, why is he in the role he's in? It's not that they question his intelligence, his innate ability, his belief in what the organization's doing. So there's none of that being questioned, but the fact that he can't control himself in these situations makes them question, you know, gosh, how committed should I be to this guy?
Well, and I completely understand that. And then they start to make other lesser judgments like, well, if he's doing this here, what's he like at home? Is this guy kind of a moron?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see it happening. Really. You know, you just, once you start that kind of slide down the, hey, I really respect you and you value your leadership. Once you start that slide down, anything's on the table. Sadly, but that's human nature.
It is, and I will tell you the saving grace for this is everybody believes that he wants what's best for the company. And then the other one is they absolutely believe, you know, he's a good human being. They don't question his ethics or his motives. So he they give him and make allowances for him that probably others might not, but they also are, and I've cautioned not just him, but everybody around the table, because they all have their issues. We all do, myself included. But you know, this gentleman's, you know, past 50. So he hasn't learned or just started misbehaving in this way, you know, in the last year. This is something he's learned to do for the past 30 years. So you can't fix that kind of innate behavior at this point in 12 months. You know, it's going to take a lot of work. Since it took him that long to get there, I think as long as he's making progress, that you probably should be willing to give a person in that case 12 to 24, maybe 36 months to really work at being a better version of themselves. And I actually think he is making progress. I get indications both in real time as well as aside from people who say, no, he's getting better. And yet they all want him to be better quicker. They all want him to be, you know, most of us want to follow a really great leader. We all crave it. And I don't care whether we're talking about in our, you know, government or in our home or in our church or wherever it might be. We all want to be led by somebody that we really are inspired by and believe in and to whom we can give a great deal of emotional commitment. So, man, you've gotten me to talk a long time on just one of the six disciplines. So I give you a lot of credit.
I'm sorry. Well, you know, I don't like to just hit one and go, here you go, go look it up. Yeah, I like to know what the foundations for these things are. So if we need to, I mean, we've got about 25 minutes and we'll go through as many as we can. But if you would like it, if we can't get all the way through, then we can schedule another podcast because this is important information.
I'd love to do it. So thank you.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Don't rush through it.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay.
Don't rush because we really want people to hear this and understand it and then take steps to make themselves better leaders and to understand and appreciate the leaders around them.
Well, I want to thank you for creating a platform where conversations like this can take place, because there's a lack of resources that people have confidence in about what they can do to make progress. And so they want to believe there's some credibility. And I see you as a clearinghouse when you have somebody on your show. I know people feel like, well, if Denise wants them on there, they must have something worthwhile to listen to. Let's just wrap up with leadership. Well, you're very welcome. Let's wrap up with one other thing. It's the first quote that I have in the book in chapter one from Peter Drucker. And what he said was, only three things happen naturally in organizations: friction, confusion, and underperformance. Everything else requires leadership. And so if you think about that, friction, confusion, and underperformance would be the natural direction that an organization will go towards unless somebody appropriately leads. And so part of what you got to ask yourself is, where's the friction in the organization that really gets in the way of us performing? Where's the confusion? Where do people not have clarity about what they should be doing or why they're doing it so that they can focus? And then where is performance not where it should be? And a lot of times it's not that a person's a bad person, but they're probably using the wrong system or process. They haven't been trained properly. And so part of you, if you think about it, Denise, every manager, I don't care whether they're frontline or the CEO, a significant part of their day should be really spent on thinking about, where are these three things going on in the part of the business for which I'm responsible? And then what am I doing to minimize it or get rid of it, so that we can literally spend our time doing the right things in a better way more often? And so that's kind of the overall approach that I'd like people to think about when they think about strategy. If that makes sense, if that's a good wrap up, then do you have any more questions on leadership?
No, I really don't. But can you state those three things again? I understand friction. What were the other two?
Yeah. Confusion and underperformance.
Perfect. I wrote those
and
down.
Confusion is when I come to a point in the day and I could do one thing or do something else. I have to make a choice. Am I going to go left or go right? And when most of us are confused, most of us hesitate. I won't say that we won't make a decision, but we'll wait. We'll slow down. And that slowing down could result in the customer waiting. That slowing down could mean that something doesn't get shipped, right? That a phone doesn't get answered.
See, I was thinking at it from a completely different perspective. I mean, I instantly, when I get confused about what is my next step, or I become unfocused, which is actually more correct, my go-to process is to do one of two things. I either go outside, I kick off my shoes and I get under my pecan trees and I ground myself. Or I head to the kitchen and I cook something, because I love to cook. And it's very creative for me. And then I come back. But I wasn't thinking of it as being in a business where you have to answer someone now. They need a response.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how different kind of entrepreneurs, solopreneurs might hear that.
Yeah, I agree with you. Most of us hate it when we get into a retail situation where we're the consumer, we're the customer, and we go into a store or we're talking to somebody on the phone, and you ask them a question, and they go, well, I'm going to have to call my boss. I'm going to have to call my supervisor.
Yeah. Better yet, let me talk to your supervisor. I'll take care of it for you.
I understand. But the point simply is when they don't know what to do, they punt, you know, they call for somebody else to make the decision that they're not sure that they can or should make. So that's what that confusion looks like, I think, in a normal day. And see, sometimes the customer who's asking for something is their own internal customer. So somebody from another department says, I need this from you. And they'll go, well, I don't know how to do that, or I don't know if I should do that. And you're asking me to make something else a priority over and above what I think my priority should be. So now I'm confused. And you know, what do most animals do when they step out in the road in front of an oncoming car?
They stop.
Their natural defense.
Headlights.
Movement is bad for them, and that's what's been trained into them. It's not that they're supposed to stop because maybe the predator won't see them. Well, that's the last thing that should probably happen when a car is coming at you. So in any event, I just think that Drucker's quote about friction, confusion, and underperformance are natural. Those are going to happen unless we stop them from happening in our companies, in our teams, our departments.
Now, doesn't that go back a bit to what you're talking about at the top of the show, where you kind of have to empower your people to say, you know, sometimes you have to give this concession to the customer, the consumer, the client. You know, you have to let them know what they can do in, you know, maybe a case that's not going to come up every other day, like Denise Griffith's calling Cox Communications. But I really do hate them. I really do. Sorry, I hope nobody's listening. I can see my internet going in about half an hour. And I'll have to clean the floor or something. But doesn't that kind of go back to how you empower your people to say, listen, sometimes you're going to have to make a split decision. How are you going to cope with it? So it's an offbeat question, but I'm a bit curious about it.
Daniel Pink's another author, and he has a book called Drive, and he speaks to what causes people to want to be fully engaged. And he says the number one thing that caused people to want to give their best of themselves every day is to be connected to some purpose beyond the work. So that's consistent with what we've already talked about. Second thing is he says people want to have job mastery. They want to become better. They want to grow. And the third thing he talks about is those first two things happen, then the last thing they want is some level of autonomy. And if you want to think about another synonym for that, would be some level of freedom. The interesting thing about autonomy and freedom is there's certain kinds of businesses that lend themselves to being able to give a lot of that to people. So, you know, if I work in a restaurant, if you and I are owners of a restaurant, and I can already tell from who you are and what you know, our conversation both today and previously, you'd be the kind of person that would say to your staff, look, if a customer is unhappy, I want you to use your judgment about how to fix that. I trust you to probably make the right call about, should I give them a dessert? Should I take it off their, you know, off their check? What should I do to make them feel better about the experience in our restaurant? And so in that kind of a situation, you could probably make autonomy. You could probably give people a lot of freedom about what they do and how they do it. As long as it's consistent overall with the direction you're trying to take the business. But if we were in, healthcare, if we were in a hospital, I think the level of autonomy that you give people probably is not as great because literally people's lives are at stake, correct?
So I think that and you're going to be sued every 10 minutes.
Yeah. So I think certain businesses and business models are probably the kind where the kind of autonomy that some people might want may not be possible just because the work we do doesn't really lend itself to letting people make it up or you know, just trust their judgment. So I do want to make sure that when we talk about giving people some autonomy and freedom and ability to think on their own, which most of us want to a degree, we also have to recognize there's certain frameworks and constraints that certain businesses have to operate under, either because of ethical or legal or health reasons why we can't just let people do what they think would be best. Having said that, most managers tend to try to prevent their people from making mistakes. So I'm going to say that one more time. Most managers and leaders, when they're working with their people, if they see them about to make a mistake, they'll stop them. And this is not a test, but why do you think a manager or leader would do that?
Because they think it will reflect badly on them.
And they might say, well, a customer might be dissatisfied. They might say it'll slow us down and we got to get this order out. So they'll use a lot of good justifications. that I would tell you, Denise. Are,
yeah,
you
but
know,
you don't
probably,
learn from being told things. You learn from putting your finger on the hot plate.
Thank you.
I mean,
thank
when
you.
We were told, don't stick your finger in the socket, and we did it anyway because, gee, Mom, thanks for giving me that idea. You learn pretty quickly, don't put your finger in the socket, right?
So therein lies the dilemma. And most of us have not gotten to where we are by being perfect. You know, we've made a number of big mistakes. And,
darn.
And so part of what we have to be willing to do is let our people make the mistakes that they need to make in order to be able to learn and grow and demonstrate whether they actually have the capacity we believe most of them have. So I'm going to say that one more time. Most of us look at the people that we have, and we see certain ones. If we got six people working for us, there's two or three that we know have a tremendous amount of talent. But when we prevent them from making mistakes that they need to gain the experience, that you can't teach them. You can't teach experience. You can only gain experience from doing things. So when we prevent them from making mistakes that become part of the experience that they need, all we're doing is slowing down their growth and their development. And so it's really crucial that we get over this idea of preventing people from making mistakes either for their benefit or for the organizations, when in fact it's just the opposite. If they have the growth potential we think, the quicker they can make the mistake, the better off we're all going to be. In fact, in some cases, we almost ought to be setting our people up to force them to make the mistakes that they need, right? We ought to teach them what they don't know by putting them in situations where they really would struggle and probably screw it up. And for that reason, they'd learn much quicker than they would if from their just, you know, being safe and doing only what's successful. So that's a personal passion of mine.
Yeah, and I love that last. I was going to ask, I mean, when you're being set up to really go into a situation where you probably will fail, that is how you learn. There's no question about it. But isn't that how, you know, Army training, military mm-hmm. training, they put you in situations where you better learn quickly and you're going to, you know,
yep.
get shot by a rubber bullet or a paint gun, but all of a sudden you go, I'm not going to go left over there anymore. So you kind of get it, right?
Yeah. And again, there's certain levels of performance that can only come from a certain number of exposures, you know, a certain number of repetitions. And if you think about it, some of the learning that I need, that situation, you can't prepare for it. You can't plan for it. That situation is going to show up once every 2 years in the business. And if you prevent me from getting to learn from that experience, good, bad, or otherwise, it's not like that teachable moment's going to reappear tomorrow, next week, or next month. It might be another year or two before we get another situation like that. So that one of the things that I really beat up the managers and executives with whom I work, Denise, is I say, you have to spend your time doing the work that only can and should be done by somebody that's a high performer in your job. So if I'm a CEO, there's certain work that only the CEO can do. If I'm the president, there's only certain kinds of things There's certain kinds of things that only the president can get done by virtue of the title and position. So if I spend my time doing work that can and should be done by others, either because I like it or because I'm afraid of letting them fail if they do it, so if I protect them by doing some work that they should be doing but they may not be good at, that means I don't have time to do the work that only I can do. So now I'm going to be trapped in doing my job successfully because I'm protecting others underneath me or protecting the organization from others underneath me because I don't have confidence in them. And so that is a real systemic kind of problem in management leadership throughout organizations that I see literally around the world, where for good reasons, the boss takes on work that should be done by others because she wants to protect the people below her because she knows how overworked they are already, or he protects the person below him because he's afraid that if they do this, they won't do it well, or they won't do it like he does it. And as a result, now they've got to do that work that's on their plate, and now they have less time to do the work that's really their job, that only they can do. So now you got me fired up.
And, you know, I'm guilty of that. When I first started my company, I'm a recovering, I had to stop myself. I am a recovering perfectionist, kind of, and I'm a recovering control freak, mostly. And it's easy to helicopter. It really is. I mean, in the beginning, I had to absolutely find a way to give my team permission to find their own way to do it, because they're all very good, very qualified at the different disciplines that they work in. And I may have a way that I want to do it, but I learned to get buy-in from them. So listen, in your own company, because they're all small business owners, just as I am, how do you do this? Do you have a better way of doing this? And the feedback is always great. And I'm sorry, my feline office assistant, Hamilton, is trying to open a door that he shouldn't be opening. So I apologize.
Hamilton, I love it.
Well, he has his own hashtag on Facebook, and it is Hamilton is an ass, and he is. So, and it's his birthday today, by the way. So he's 2 years old, and he's acting like it. But the thing is, I learned that very early on, because I like to do things my own way, and I would also – yeah, and this was always my excuse that, I'll just, instead of handing it off to a team member, it'll take me 20 minutes to write the brief. I'll just do it myself. Wrong move for so many reasons.
Wrong move. Exactly. For so many reasons. It's not just the impact it has on you. It's the impact it has on them. It's the impact it has on the entire organization, because you're not using the resources you have optimally. So, I'm glad you confronted that.
You can be a small business, a solopreneur. You can be a big business. But the thing is, and I have learned this through trial and error and going, really, at the end of the day, Denise, I'm exhausted. Why did you do all of that work? That was $20 an hour work. Why did you do the $50 an hour work? You're at a much higher level. And I would be irritated and exhausted and just emotionally frazzled because I was beating myself up. But the thing is, it was just that control thing, but it wasn't emotionally smart. And once I figured that out, give up the control, get the work done, bring your team in, give them the big picture, let them kind of buy into what the whole process is, things just go so much better.
Amen. You're preaching to the choir.
I figured.
Thank you for the time today, Denise. I've really enjoyed it. And I'd love to come back if you'll allow me and talk about a couple of the other topics in the book.
Well, we've still got about 7 minutes. So let's move on to the next one if you have time.
Great.
Yeah, keep going.
I thought we were close to our stopping time. Well, great. Well, I want to jump from leadership to strategy, and strategy at the business level is when the organization makes really conscious choices about what they'll be and who they'll serve, and to the extent that it also means they won't spend time and energy pursuing opportunities that don't fit with those specific ones that they've identified. So I want to pick McDonald's because they're an easy target. They get beat up a lot. But I think it's clear McDonald's knows who they are, and they know who they're trying to serve. So they're not trying to give people the illusion that when they come into a McDonald's that, one, the service is going to be this, five-star experience. And the second thing is they're not going to try to you're not going to go in there and try to order things other than the proteins that they offer and the fried foods that they offer, right? They've made it very, very clear. So the systems that they have, the process that they have, the way they structure their stores and where they put them are all designed to attract and make it easy for people who want to be a customer for McDonald's to be a customer for McDonald's. And so McDonald's knows who they're trying to serve in their stores. And not all of us are necessarily customers of McDonald's, but in fact, McDonald's knows who they want to be their customer. And so they've created their systems, processes, and their structure to support that. So that's kind of the thing we're talking about, is that you really define very clearly who do you want to do transactions with, And then you're going to build your systems and your processes and the structure of your organization to support trying to do those kinds of transactions. And so many companies struggle at being focused on who they'll serve. They fear, I think it's inherent as entrepreneurs, most of us fear taking away options because we initially needed all those options just to stay in business. But at some point, if we're going to grow, if we're going to become a bigger version of what we're currently doing and do it profitably, then we have to limit the number of things we try to be good at becoming good at. And so that's really what strategy is all about. And it's most elementary. When we have a strong strategy, we've made choices. We've chosen some things to be more important than others. So I think that, again, if I'm not the manager or not the CEO or the president, how does strategy affect what I do? Well, number one, it should be a guide for the things where I should put my time and energy and effort. But also, it means I also need to be good at then extending those choices down through the part of the organization that I manage or lead. So when you think about it, I need to be able to create very clear priorities for the people that work for me and the people that work with me to be able to understand what their priorities are for a given week or month, perhaps even for a given day. And so sometimes you might have to say, I know what you would be normally doing today, but everything that we've got to get done, this is the number one thing, the most important thing you need to think about and work on and get some progress on today. If you don't get anything else done, make sure you get some work done in this area. So that kind of clarity allows people to focus, and that kind of clarity allows organizations to deploy their resources, that's money, that's time, that's people, that's their facility, their hard assets, deploy those in the most optimal way. And so without that kind of conscious choice, so often what you see is the organization whipsaw. They churn, they oscillate. They're kind of like stuck in a rocking chair where they make two steps forward, but they make two steps back because they really haven't committed to being one thing above all else. And I'm trying to think of a company that maybe has struggled with that. And I'm going to throw somebody out there that I think in the last few years has maybe lost their way a bit. And I'm going to say Apple.
Cox Communications.
Apple for years.
I had to get it in there.
I thought I might hear that term again. But if you think about it, Denise, in the last few years since Steve Jobs died, I kind of feel like Apple has stumbled a bit. I don't know. What's your thoughts about that? They don't seem as focused as they used to be.
They don't. And I am an Apple product, you know, user. I have three iPads. I just got the iPad Pro last week,
yeah,
which I love. And I have an iPhone. I don't the iPad desktops and Macs, I don't like those. I don't care for the operating system for some reason, which is odd, but I find that they're almost trying to be too much. You know, they're kind
yeah.
of, I don't know. And I can't point to anything, but I just feel like their focus is just not as tight and as narrow as it should have been or has been, because with Apple, you always knew what you were getting, period.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an
yeah.
idea. I've never been unhappy with their customer service before, the customer experience, which is a whole different thing, and we'll talk about that. But I accidentally ordered the iPad Pro in silver. I didn't want silver. I wanted rose gold. So I immediately caught it, you know, when they sent me the confirmation email, and I immediately caught it, called AT&T, and I got the biggest runaround you would ever believe. I mean, it was Cox Communications level runaround. One last
bad.
Time, I promise. But, you know, they had somebody say, I said, I just want to change it. Well, we can't change it for your security. What security? I just want to change the color. So I had basically a 30-minute conversation online chat. Then I got kicked to a supervisor who said, oh, well, we can't do that anyway, because the original person said, oh, well, okay, we can change it, do this, that, and the other. Then I'm told by a supervisor, no, that can't be done. She said, you'll have to go reorder it, and we will cancel out the other one. Well, my response, as you can imagine, was, I don't think I'm going to do that because – you just spent 45 minutes assuring me that it can be done. It can't be done. I don't really trust the system. Her response, Ed, was, well, if you don't trust me, I can't help you. Click, and that was it. Really?
Ooh.
Yeah. All righty, then. So the next day I got up, and I actually had a chat with somebody at Apple, which resulted in tears, not mine. And, you know, I did get the iPad Pro that I wanted, but it was incredibly frustrating. That's never happened, and I've been a consumer of theirs for years. So that's a big problem for me.
Yeah. Well, it appears, you know, that I'm not the only one that just feels like they've lost their laser-like focus that they used to have. And I don't know if that's because Steve Jobs is no longer there, or if it's just because they've gotten to a point in the size of a company where it's just so difficult to be laser-like focused. And you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how well they do over the next few years, because in the past, because even when they did screw up, their customer service was so good that it caused you to go, well, shoot, you know, I as long as they fix it and they make it so pleasurable to get it fixed, why would I change? But when they take that away, it makes it really easy to consider other options.
Yeah, my eyebrows went straight into my hairline. I promise you. I said, you've got to be kidding me. This, I would have never expected this to happen. I kept a transcript of it just to make sure that I wasn't making it up in my own head. It was pretty bizarre.
Well,
for Apple,
one of the ways that we know we have a good strategy, or probably have the courage to have a good strategy, is if you've you know, think about the last time you had a conversation with one of your people where you said, we probably shouldn't do business with this prospective client, you know, where we turn down business because we know it doesn't fit with who we are and who we're trying to be. So if you're not saying no to certain customers every once in a while, you're probably trying to be everything to everybody. So that would be one thing that I would suggest that you ought to look for in the way you're doing business to see if you're being strategic. I think, do you really have something unique that truly differentiates you from your competitors? And the simple answer for most companies is they don't. And so what they'll try to run to is they'll say, well, our customer service is going to be better. But in reality, it probably isn't that much different. And unless you can have true ways of measuring and show that your customer service is truly better than anybody with whom you compete, and that your customers are actually willing to pay you for that, then and give you a premium for that, then you probably don't have a difference that's significant enough to warrant being strategic. And then I think the last test that I really like to do in an organization is I'll go to some person at a lower level, and I would ask them, who are you trying to serve? Who do you think the customer really is that you should most value? What size are they? You know, what kind of business are they in? I'd try to get somebody, you know, two or three levels from the executive suite to tell me who the company's trying to serve. And if they hem and haw, if they give me a very mundane, you know, very average answer, or they stumble with it, then I can tell you that even if the company has a great strategy, it's not understood. And the company isn't living it. The company isn't making the choices that are required to really demonstrate to the rest of the organization that we're committed to trying to do more of our business with these kinds of companies than others. So that's really, I think, kind of the indicators about whether or not the strategy that the company has is the right strategy, or whether or not they're actually living it, whether they've made the tough decisions or choices.
And
how are
they
doing
can
on time?
Be. Well, we stopped recording, we stopped streaming, but we're still recording, so we're good.
Okay.
But I wanted to go back just very quickly, and I know we're going to reschedule you. I wanted to kind of go back to the restaurant analogy, and I'm losing my voice, so just kind of bear with me a bit here. But one of the things, and I don't eat out at restaurants very often because, you know, it's really not particularly healthy. It can get expensive. And frankly, I like my own cooking better than I do most restaurants. But when I do, if I go into, let's just say, a chain restaurant, I don't even know, Denny's, pick one, I guess, and
sure,
which I will never go into, by the way. But when you walk in to a restaurant and the menu requires that you sit there with it and flip pages and study it before you can figure out what the heck it is that you want to eat. They're serving everybody and nobody in particular. Get out of there.
Right.
Seriously.
Right.
But if you go to a high-end restaurant where the, you know, it's printed on one side, the wine list is on the other, and you have maybe five or six choices, but you know all of them are going to be excellent, where are you going to choose to go?
Well, yeah, most of us would choose the latter over the former, unless it's the day after a hangover. But that would be the normal choice, right? And
gotcha.
And it's clear when they're trying to, when the menu's limited, it's probably a pretty good indication, clear focus of who they're trying to serve.
I think that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. When the menu's broad and wide and they're, you know, trying to have one of everything, it's pretty clear that their target is trying to please everybody. And that, think about how hard that is to manage. Think about what you have to have in stock to try to please everybody. It's expensive. So I, you know, generally speaking, what most people that I work with who really refine their strategy and get specific on it, what I almost universally hear from them, Denise, after the fact is, how in the hell did we ever stay in business without this? When we didn't have a strategy, how did we survive? Because we didn't make these tough choices. And so that's what most people find is once they start to make the tough choices, the business actually becomes so much simpler. So that's one of the reasons that we're pretty emphatic that most companies really need to be challenged about, do they have a good strategy, one that they can really believe in and are willing to and really make the tough choices to behave in a manner consistent with that.
That makes complete sense to me. Listen, Ed, thank you for staying over with me. I really appreciate it, and I'm genuinely looking forward to having you come back. Where can people find you on the web?
TheEppleyGroup.com. So it's the word the and then Eppley, E-P-P-L-E-Y, group, all one word, .com. And so that's my website, and you can order the book there. You can also reach out, and I have some assessments you can do there to see where you are and how well you're doing in each of the six professional management disciplines. And then I'm also on the website for the Table Group. So if you go to tablegroup.org, you'll find me there. And I'm also on Aileron's website. So Aileron is Aileron.org as well. So I'm a bit like a bad penny, Denise. I show up everywhere.
I always tell people you can't hit, you know, look for me on the internet. You can't literally throw a stick on the internet without hitting me. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay, remind people what the name of the book is so they can go look for it deliberately.
Sure. It's called Let's Be Clear, The Six Disciplines of Focus Management Pros. And you can get that either on our website or Amazon.com. They'll have it in there as well. Okay.
Excellent. Ed, thank you so much. It has been a genuine pleasure speaking with you. And I'm really, like I said earlier, really looking forward to having you come back. And I thank you for all the wonderful tips and the advice that you shared with our audience. But before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. I said it right. Woo-hoo. Ed, thank you.
Yay. Thanks, Denise. I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too.
You can find Denise Griffith at yourofficeonthewebcom or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.